Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Turning Confusion into Wisdom, a How-To Guide by Lama Cathy Wesley. It's said that the teachings of the Buddha claim we can turn our confusion into wisdom. While this is an intriguing idea, we are left to wonder, how do we do that exactly? Relying on the teachings of Venerable Trungpa Rinpoche and Venerable Kempo Carter Rinpoche, Lama Cathy talks about the promise of inner transformation and some strategies for accomplishing it day by day. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
First of all, I want to thank everyone for being here today. Really appreciate your coming to visit us as you do, and you bring your sincerity. You bring your sincerity and goodness to this place, and I want to thank you for bringing that. Because this meditation room is actually a container for all of us. It's a container for us to kind of become our best self. And the fact that you come here week after week and bringing your sincerity and your true self to this place, and that you infuse this place with your own aspiration to goodness, that means a lot. I happen to believe that each of us has a Buddha within us, and that's a basic teaching of the Buddha Shakyamuni, is that all beings have the potential to wake up to their own basic Buddha nature. Everybody has that potential. There's no one who's born without it. Everybody has it. And how they uncover it will be individual to them. And that's why I'm so proud and happy of the work that the folks, all the volunteers here, are putting in, because every person is different for how their Buddha nature can be manifested and how their Buddha nature can be uncovered. And so that's what, we're all very different. I think you may have noticed this. Some people like one kind of practice. Some people like to sit and meditate sitting. Just quiet sitting meditation, that really helps them. Another group of people might be benefited by the chanting of mantra and the use of visualizations. So mantra and visualization might be a path for somebody else. And for yet another kind of person, the path may be compassion. And that is why the name of this center contains not just our family name, Karma, because we are of the Karmapa's lineage, but Teksum, which is our middle name. Chuling means Dharma place, but the middle name, Teksum, refers to the three vehicles of the Buddha's teaching. So it's like the Buddha taught three ways of uncovering our Buddha nature and coming to a realization of who we are. And so that's why we teach all three of these styles of meditation here, because you may or may not like compassion meditation. You may or may not like mantra meditation. You may or may not like shamatha meditation, but they're all here for you. They're all here for you, and you can practice them all, and all of them will help you uncover your Buddha nature. So when people bring their sincerity to this place and want to learn these things, it makes me incredibly happy. So last week, I got the blessing of teaching twice this month because of people traveling and whatnot. And so I said, well, a two-parter would be good. Let's do one part on this room, which was last week's talk, called we called it A Palace of Our Own, because this is meant to look like those beautiful palaces that are spoken about in Buddhist iconography. And if you remember the round mandala drawings, right, the round mandala drawings, that those are patterned after a Buddha field, a beautiful awakened Buddha field, and that inside that Buddha field there is a palace, and inside that palace is a Buddha, and that Buddha is us. And right now, we have to have exterior reminders of our Buddha nature in the palace that is represented by the strings and garlands of bells and drapery that is represented by the top of the wall decorations here. The top of the wall decorations here are meant to be to evoke a Buddha palace. And the clouds, of course, are in the sky because there's part of the palace that's a clear story at the top of the wall so that air can pass through and ring the bells. I mean, it's evocative stuff. And now this week we even have the garland hanging from the very top. It's really amazing. So we talked about how we have a very mundane idea of ourself most of the time. We have a lot of preoccupation with mundane things. I got to get up. I got to go to work. I got to clean the house. I got to cook the meals. I got to, you know. I have this responsibility. I have that responsibility, and so on. So that's our world right now. And the practice of Dharma is meant to help us to understand that there's more to our life and mind than just the gotta do stuff. And that we can gradually transform our confusion and our confused surroundings into wisdom surroundings. And so that is today's topic. Today's topic is turning confusion into wisdom. And I want to apologize at the outset. I'm kind of bad at planning things in advance. And so I had this great idea in my mind that I was going to show you slides of the five wisdom Buddhas, you know, and going to show you about that. And then I forgot until like this morning that we only have one working TV. So, and that the guy who is using it in the Intro to Buddhism class needs it. So I didn't want to fight, you know, because we're Buddhists, we're lovers, not fighters. And so so I decided to deputize Don, our sound and AV guy. And so if you want to go back and see all of the pictures I'm describing today, they will be on the YouTube video because he's posting them as we go. So anyhow, that's a bit of an introduction. I will continue to work toward being a better planning person. So meanwhile, let's start our time together with a prayer of taking refuge. We'll recite this prayer two times in English and then recite it a third time in Tibetan so that we dedicate this session to the attainment of awakening by all beings. We'll start with the words, in the Buddha. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly, most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly, most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Now, I'll recite this in Tibetan. Or Sanje Chudan Soji Cho Namla Jang Chu Pardu Tani Kyap Suchi Da ji jin so ji bei si nam ki dro la Okay, thank you. And now I'll recite one more short prayer of my own, and then we'll begin.
Or Palden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chi Or Pede Ten Shala Kadrin Jembo Kone Che Sun Te Kusum Tugin Udrup Sal Tu So.
Thank you. So, I'm going to be talking about two things today. One is going to be the artwork, and the other is about how the artwork reflects what's within us. As I said at the beginning, we start from a place of confusion. Most of us are somewhat familiar with our top five favorite mental afflictions. Yeah. I almost feel like, you know, it's in the list, in this world of internet lists. What are the five most popular mental afflictions? Read and find out. In Buddhism, they talk about five basic mental afflictions. And then they also then talk about three basic mental afflictions. And then finally, they talk about one basic mental affliction. When you talk about one basic mental affliction, it's ignorance. We don't know that we have Buddha nature. And because we don't know that we have Buddha nature, we run around we sort of run amok in the world, saying and doing whatever we want, trying to get what we think is happiness. Because we see the sources of happiness as being external, not internal. And so because of that, we interact with the outside world like it's going to give us everything we need and make us happy. And that's where all the confusion of this world that we call samsara arises from. We don't know that there's another way to be. We don't know that there's another way to think and another way to live. We just think there's one way, and it's the external world. But if we get a sense that there's more to life than just the external world, there's something more that we need to know about and to be part of, that's when we start to turn our attention inward and work on the spiritual dimension. But we'll still run into some more mental afflictions because there will be attachment to the things we like, aversion to the things we don't like, and then we may end up feeling superior to others and being prideful and arrogant because we're so smart. And then we may actually think there are others who are better than us and feel jealous. So these mental afflictions, ignorance, attachment, aversion, pride, and jealousy are all part and parcel of being human in this world. And at first, we might feel a little discouraged by this scenario, thinking, well, if I've got all these mental afflictions, how am I ever going to uncover my Buddha nature? Well, I have some good news for you. In all of the teachings that the Buddha gave, of all three vehicles, basic sitting meditation, compassion meditation, and mantra meditation among the practices, all of them work with these five mental afflictions, all of them. When you're sitting in meditation and doing your shamatha practice, and you're sitting there and you're with your breath coming in and you're with your breath coming out, and then suddenly a thought arises, and that thought might be one of your five major mental afflictions. It might be a thought of pride or jealousy, or it might be a thought of even bewilderment, like, what should I do? And, or attachment or aversion. All of these mental afflictions come up for us usually as thoughts. We may think of our thoughts as being emotions, but that's because thoughts and emotions are so closely closely related. They're so closely related that when we have a thought and it turns into an emotion, we almost can't see the seam where it goes over from being just a thought to being something else. I use the example of someone, if you ever have a fight with somebody, if seeing that person again, like, I don't know about you, but if I have a fight with someone and then I see them coming through that door, I will have a thought, and it might not be a positive thought. Okay, but look at that, just that experience of seeing somebody that you quarreled with coming through the door, and how does that work exactly? First, your eyes take in the information of someone coming through the door, and then your thinking mind looks at that picture and says, it's them. And once your thinking mind gets hold of it, then all of the reactions that we habitually have to people that we feel in conflict with, they just like arise instantly. We almost don't have to order them. They're already there. It's like coming to your favorite diner and they've already got your drink order waiting for you. So right there, they happen so quickly that we're almost not aware that thoughts become emotions instantly. Really, I tell people that emotions are really just thoughts that have hired a really great advertising company, because those thoughts are accompanied by physical sensations, such as feeling cold when you're afraid or feeling hot when you're angry. And because of these physical sensations, that's the advertising agency. You know, your physical sensations that you are habituated to having when you are afraid or sleepy, sneezy, dopey doc, whatever you are, right? You know, so no matter what you're feeling, that is like the advertising, the hype man for what is going on inside you. And so what we have to do is we have to recognize the hype, and we have to say, let's step backwards and try to take one step back away from that feeling, just so you can look at it. Not so you don't feel it, but so that you don't have to immediately hop on that speeding car and start waving. So that's the work of meditation, is to slow that process down. That's what shamatha meditation is for, what mindfulness meditation does. When you're sitting and watching your breath and a thought comes up, if it's an emotional thought, you might feel something in the pit of your stomach. But then if you are practicing the quiet sitting meditation discipline, you notice that you're thinking and not meditating, and then you label it thinking and you let it go, and then return your attention to the breath and think of that as a fresh start for your meditation. When we do this over and over and over again, we create a new habit that isn't instantaneously reactive. It's not like we go from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. It isn't like that anymore. It slows it down. That's the function. And just slowing it down a few seconds can sometimes give us a better chance of reacting in a different, more contemplative, more considered way. Just can buy us time to key into our kind of our higher nature, our better selves. And the same is true for the practice of compassion meditation. When we feel those negative mental afflictions in the discipline called Lojong or compassion meditation, Lojong, L-O-J-O-N-G, Lojong means mind training. And what we're training our mind to do is we're training our mind to notice emotional states and then take hold of them and work with them right there on the spot. And when we work with them, we're given a method for working with them. And that method is to key into our basic motivation for goodness. We call it the bodhisattva motivation in Buddhism. Bodhi means awakening. It's derived from the word Buddha. Bodhi, Buddha, Bodhi. So Bodhi is awakening, waking up to our Buddha nature, waking up to our best self. And Citta means mind. So bodhicitta is the mind that wants to wake up, and the bodhisattva is a person who's working on their bodhicitta. And so in mind training, when an emotional reaction comes up, we take hold of that emotional reaction and say, what would a bodhisattva do in this situation? And the bodhisattva in most situations would take a moment, step back, and look at the situation and say, what is the best response for myself and for others? And respond from a place of caring for oneself and respond from a place of caring for another. That's what that interplay is all about. That's what the mind training is all about. Not so that we don't feel our mental afflictions or that we try to hide them in a box somewhere, but that we experience them in the context of love and compassion. Love and compassion for ourselves and love and compassion for others. We attempt to create that context that we can experience our emotions in and find a better way to be with them so that they don't become, I guess you could say, energy drains for us. Because I don't know about you, but sometimes I waste a lot of time going around, 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 around. I feel like a hamster in a wheel, you know, going around and around, trying to solve something that might not be solvable, or trying to relitigate an argument that I lost, thinking it'll turn out differently if I think about it enough. So we have to find ways to slow that process down, and that's compassion meditation and Lojong and quiet sitting. And mantra meditation is yet another way that we can work with mental afflictions. And this is where the five Buddhas come in. Remember, there are five mental afflictions. You might think, well, five mental afflictions, they're going to gang up on me. I'm outnumbered by my mental afflictions. I'm outnumbered. But in the Buddha's teaching, it is said that when we see and experience the quiet awareness of our Buddha nature, these mental afflictions are not only rendered harmless because they don't have any place to grow, they're not just rendered harmless, that if we just experience their inner nature, we will experience them as expansive awareness and wisdom. When we are no longer angry in a situation, let's say that you're really angry about something, and then you suddenly learn that it was all a misunderstanding. In that moment, all that anger disappears. It's gone. And in its place is this release of openness, this release of basic goodness, which is our basic nature. And through that, we can experience one of the five wisdoms. This is a too big of a topic for today, first of all, darn it. When each of these negative mental afflictions, you know, arises, if we can let them go, they become something else. And if we can let anger go, it becomes a type of wisdom called the mirror-like wisdom. And I'm going to read to you from an extremely tiny book. I mean, it's really tiny, and you can buy it for $1.25 online as a PDF. It's pretty nice. It's called The Five Buddha Families and the Eight Consciousnesses, and it's by Trungpa Rinpoche, T-H-R-A-N-G-U, Trungpa Rinpoche. And here's what he says about mirror-like wisdom. When our negative mental afflictions are purified, we experience the wisdom of the five Buddha families. He says, As ordinary beings, we perceive everything through our confused consciousnesses, which are under the influence of an incorrect view of the world, because our mind is overwhelmed by our disturbing emotions. And by purifying this mundane consciousness through the practice of meditation, sacred outlook is achieved and everything is seen in its purity. This is not the one for anger. I'm wrong about this. I'm going to have to go back and check this out again because I may have made a mistake. When the basic consciousness is purified, mirror-like wisdom dawns so that self and others are perceived purely, like a reflection in a mirror. And this is the realization of the Buddha, Akshobhya. So this is the overcoming of anger, because this Buddha, which is viewed as being blue in color, is the purification of anger. And so he goes on to explain each of the five Buddhas. I'll ask for the slide that the very last slide in the set, which is a picture of five Buddhas up and down and across and up and down and crossways. In this image, you will see the five Buddhas represented in their directions. Each Buddha is associated with a different mental affliction in a different direction. The blue Buddha that is Akshobhya is in the east, and he represents the overcoming of anger. Ratnasambhava is in the south, and he is yellow in color and represents the overcoming of pride. Amitabha is in the west, and he is red in color and symbolizes the overcoming of attachment. Amoghasiddhi is a Buddha that is in the north direction, and he purifies the mental affliction of jealousy. And he, yes, is green in color. And the Buddha in the center is white, and the Buddha's center in the center is Varachana, who is the overcoming of ignorance. So each of the Buddhas, Akshobhya is the overcoming of anger, Ratnasambhava is yellow and is the overcoming of pride, Amitabha is the overcoming of attachment, Amoghasiddhi is the overcoming of jealousy, and Varachana is the overcoming of basic ignorance. And you'll see this reflected in the painting that you'll see as our illustration. Each one of these is the overcoming of a problem that we have and a transformation of that problem into something amazing, something awakened, something marvelous. And so I wanted to at least bring your attention to that. And there's one other illustration I wanted to bring your attention to. Let me see here. I want to see which of this I want to share. Yeah, I think that it's a little bit difficult to try to explain all of them, but I'm going to read it into the record and then go back and explain it. This Ratnasambhava, the purity of pride. Trungpa Rinpoche says that we, when we get into jealousy and have trouble with people, he said, when the dualism of jealousy is purified, the wisdom of equality is realized so that there's no clinging to the idea of self and others. And so then when the attachment is overcome, we see the discriminating wisdom Usually discrimination means that we see differences in people and then get attached to and make judgments. But what if we saw the differences in people and saw that we're all the same, and yet we're so unique? And that's discriminating wisdom. And all accomplishing wisdom is when we have jealousy, we think we're better than others and that we want to compete with them. But when that is relinquished and we realize the wisdom that is called all accomplishing wisdom, he says, this wisdom allows us to realize the nature of all of the Dharma students and all of their fellow Dharma practitioners and to help them along the path. And then finally, ignorance, when ignorance is removed, he said, it is called the wisdom of Dharmata. This ground is, when this ground consciousness is purified, we no longer react with any habitual patterns, and the wisdom of basic goodness shines forth. So in any case, I thought it would be fun to talk about these five Buddhas and describe them, because those five Buddhas are, of course, the reflected in the five colors that you see in this room. Let's see. I have one paragraph from the book I wanted to share, and then I'll show the final point that I wanted to make. Okay. We all have these confusions in our life. And we all have confusion, mental afflictions, pride, jealousy, and all the rest. And we might get discouraged about that. But once we get the methodology of meditation working for us, once we get that methodology working for us, we no longer need to be afraid of our mental afflictions. We can actually begin engaging with them in healthy and constructive ways. And even just being able to engage with our own anger and attachment in a much more constructive way than we've been doing so far, that is itself a transformation. Because it used to be we would jump into the wheel and be like the hamster running around and around and around. But when we began to experience our mental afflictions with love, compassion, and wisdom, we changed how we thought about ourselves and how we thought about others. And we feel that release and goodness that's within us. So in any case, I just wanted to say these methods of transformation are available to us right now, and we can begin to work with them. And it may be a while before we manifest a Buddha palace of our own, but at the very least, we can begin the process of transformation just by showing up for ourselves every day on our meditation seat and being with ourselves every day in our meditation seat and working with others from the place of meditation. So Don, I'm going to ask for one more picture, and I'm going to read to you something, this description. Do you remember last week when I was describing what the Buddha realm looked like and why this is called a palace? Well, I was doing all of that from memory. I thought it would be good if I read to you what Trungpa Rinpoche has to say about this. There's an illustration called the Buddha, Phi Buddha Mandala. And you will see it when you watch the video later. It's the Buddha Mandala. You remember those mandalas made out of sand, where the sand paintings, and they have the external, there's a circle at the outside, and then there's a square in the middle, and the square is described as being the Buddha Palace, and here we are inside one. Well, here's what Trungpa Rinpoche has to say about this. He says, a mandala is a representation of what is to be visualized in a mantra or Vajrayana practice. The mandala is represented on paintings and in sand paintings in two dimensions. And one needs a key to see how to convert a two-dimensional mandala into a three-dimensional palace. The outer rim of the mandala, which is denoted in the drawing by the number one, is a vertical ring of fire representing the protective fire around a palace, and which is seen on the outside of most of these. Next is a ring of lotuses, which represent enlightenment, showing that this palace is a pure land, not an ordinary place. The next light circle is on the top, and this is the horizontal to the ground. And standing on this ground is a four-sided palace with four doors facing the four directions. The doors have to be visualized as standing upright. Each door has a large lintel over it, and a peacock standing on the left and a prayer wheel standing on the right. Your peacocks and prayer wheels will be optional. We can see that inside the door is a banner which is hanging down from the top of the entrance. We haven't got ours yet. Inside this is the roof of the palace, which has a transparent room, and we can see from the four lines going to the center that the palace has a four-sided triangular roof, which comes to a point in the middle. Inside the mandala are five symbols or implements, one for each of the five Buddha families, and we can see where they are because the roof is transparent. Now the mandala for each deity practice is different, but almost all are far more elaborate than the one that is depicted in the drawing. But this is how they generally appear. And so it will kind of delight you to think about that this room that we're sitting in right now is representative of all of the qualities of Buddhahood. All of the qualities of the five wisdoms are represented by these five colors. And it's something that we can surround ourselves with, both through visualization and through our practice. We may not be able to visualize a Buddha palace, but what we can do is feel the relief we feel when we realize that our anger is caused by a misunderstanding that we can let go of. That's a good feeling, and it's a good feeling to be able to let go. So that letting go is what allows, that letting go of fixation is what allows us to experience our confusion as wisdom. I'll be talking about this in a different location next week. There'll be a Dharma teaching here at 11:30 next week, and I'll be talking at the Athens KTC next week, and hopefully that will be recorded, and then you can learn more about the transformation of confusion into wisdom. Fingers crossed. So we've got a lot of time for questions. So you can ask questions about the iconography of this room, about the five poisons. You can talk about just about anything. So if you want to ask a question, we do ask that you use the microphone, because that way people online can hear you, and the people here can hear you. So if you have questions, feel welcome to come up and ask.
Thanks, Lama Kathy.
Hey.
You said something about the physical sensations being the advertisement for the thought, and I found that really interesting. It reminded me of some of the advice about sitting, that when you're sleepy, you can raise your gaze, or when you're really active, you can lower your gaze. And it seemed to me like that was maybe playing with the volume of that advertisement, and I wondered if that was maybe an accurate way to think about it, and if so, if there are other tips for when we've reached the point where the body is really caught up in that.
When it's doing its thing, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, what I meant is, and I really appreciate you asking for the clarification, because I do tend to speak quickly, and I think, I don't think I spoke correctly there. What I was trying to draw the differentiation between is the difference between a thought and the concept of an emotion. because a lot of people think that thoughts and emotions are different, and they're not really different. It's so interesting to read about the life of the Buddha and how he taught and the concepts that he taught that were unusual. And instead of calling things thoughts, feelings, and emotions, he actually leveled the playing field when he talked about these thoughts, feelings, and emotions. Because, you know, as humans, we give more value to feelings and more value to emotions because somehow they're jazzed up thoughts, right? They're better than thoughts. We think that they're different than thoughts, first of all, and then we think they're better, and that maybe we need to listen to them more. Anyhow, that's the basic idea. Well, the Buddha actually said, no, they're all the same. He called them all mental events. I'm having a mental event. And so he was trying to get people to see the sameness of thoughts, feelings, and emotions. And that's why I made up the image of the hype man or the advertiser. Because we have habitual reactions to specific kinds of thought. Like, ever since I was a child, if somebody tells me that I'm stupid, I really don't like it. It's like a habitual, you know, and so that's hard for me. And so because of my habit of reacting that way, whenever that thought comes up or somebody says it to me, it actually feels like it's more than just a thought. But it is really always just a thought. And if we can see through the hype and see through the advertisement, you see, then we can actually begin to work with the thought that was the birth of that emotion. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
And then in your example, I like your example, actually, because your example is when we're sitting in meditation, one of the things we're taught to do at first is to allow our gaze to rest on the floor or downward in front of us. And that as we get more, as we gain more familiarity with the technique, we can actually raise the gaze so that we can look straight out. And I thought that was really interesting that you compared the downward gaze to turning down the volume on the hype. Because it really, I can see it doing that. Because when our gaze is downward, we're not as engaged. We're not as engaged with the external world, number one. We're not as engaged with sort of the machinery of habit, the machinery of habitual reaction. So anyhow, I'm thinking it's turning down the volume is pretty good. When people are doing meditation retreats, sometimes they're taught to practice when they're between sessions. They're taught to like not look at each other. Don't be looking at your neighbor. Don't be making eye contact in the hallways. You know, because they're trying to get people to be more internal.
Oh, they looked at me funny, right? Okay, that makes sense.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I love these questions. These are great. Yes. Hi, good morning.
Hi. So, kind of two smaller questions. First one's real simple. Would you consider these mental afflictions kleshas?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's you know, for the benefit of folks who haven't heard the word before, I'll say that the word mental affliction can be translated into both Tibetan and into Sanskrit. And in Sanskrit, it's aklesha, which is spelled K-L-E-S-H-A, klesha, in Sanskrit. And then in Tibetan, I think it's nyumong, and I can't spell that. But, you know, hopefully that helps.
And then the other question was, so you said the five basic mental afflictions were ignorance, attachments, aversion, pride, and jealousy.
Yes, sir.
So how does anger work its way into that?
Aversion, I think, is, I think the word aversion is used to describe that. And so when we experience something that we think of as being harmful, we feel aversion toward that. But that aversion can take so many different forms. There's a lot of different flavors of aversion. There's just not liking something. There's really being feeling a strong distaste and hatred, a rejection, an anger. You can really, the continuum of aversion is quite big, very mild, like irritation, frustration. But then it can even go, it can even blossom into harming oneself or harming others, you know. So it can go the whole, it can run the whole gamut. But all of those mental afflictions are flavors or types of aversion. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps to contextualize it. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, anger, that's a tough one, man. Because, you know, yeah, you can just, yeah, there you go, you got it, good.
So the five Buddha families have five colors, and like our t-shirts that we have for sale downstairs have the five colors. But then our banner, our wallpaper here, has four colors, green, red, blue, and yellow. But then I'm thinking that the one that's on the ceiling, which is three different colors with multicolor flags, does that represent the white Rajna Buddha, because just as white light contains all the colors, the Vrajna Dharmadatta wisdom is the basic wisdom of all the other four Buddha families?
I'm going to have to get back to you on that, but white is included in the color display. It's just not real super present.
Because it's like clouds are white, but here they're depicted as colors, including orange.
Yeah, reproduction may vary, but yes, there's supposed to be a white color included with that. So yeah, that's the purification of ignorance.
Okay.
But I can't tell you about the philosophical idea of, because you can say that of both black and white, that black is the sum of all colors, and that white is the sum of all colors. You can say that, but I don't really understand the science of color well enough to be able to say they're right.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
So about the five Buddha families, I'm wondering, are they just like an interesting roadmap? Or are there ways to, through practice, engage with one Buddha or another? For example, if sort of like Myers-Briggs, like personality type, you figure out, like you're more of a, I don't know how to say it right, Vairochana, like is there a way to, if you discover that about yourself, if you're leaning towards anger or one of the other ones, to directly work with that in your practice?
Bingo. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, in his book Dharma Paths, he encourages us to become familiar with our favorite mental afflictions, you know, and kind of rank them, you know. And he said this serves two purposes. Number one, he said you'll know what you got to work with. And number two, you won't be surprised when other people point them out to you. Which they will do, you know. They'll tell you what your faults are. You'll hear about it all the time. And instead of getting defensive, you can just say, oh, that's number five. Anyway, but so that's the first point, is that yes, it's important for us to look at our being and kind of do a scan of our personality and find out what mental afflictions are kind of the strongest for us. And then each of the Buddha families, you can practice practices from those particular Buddha families in order to overcome a specific type of mental affliction. Although it's also said in Buddhist teachings that if you learn to practice one Buddha or one Bodhisattva, you're actually able to practice them all. Because you don't have to think, well, I've got like all five mental afflictions. Does this mean I have to practice all five Buddhas? But the answer is start with the one that is predominant for you. But what you'll find is that frequently that will actually help you with all the others too. Because all of the mantra practices help us to see ourselves differently and to let go of our clinging to being bad ourselves or thinking less of ourselves and so on. So hopefully doing these types of mantra practices will help us see the goodness in ourselves as well and see the sacredness in our being. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. His Holiness, the 17th Karmapa, tells the story of being very quick-tempered as a youth, and that he took on the practice of the Buddha Akshobhya, and that he really made great progress with his quick-temperedness because of that. And in fact, he says, I'm of the opinion that humanity needs this Buddha Akshobhya right now, because we're feeling a lot of anger for lots of reasons. And we need to overcome that. So he said, my dream, he said, is to create an Akshobhya pavilion in the United States where people can come and practice the Buddha Akshobhya to help overcome all of this anger. So anyway, yes. How are we doing on time? Oh, good, yeah. This might be the last question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hopefully this makes sense. With the afflictions, I know that as I'm going through this and everything, I know resentments are a huge piece that cause a lot of negativity in my life. And working through those and with the different practices like the shamatha and the loving compassion and stuff, I guess the biggest thing, if I'm understanding it, is the shamatha is learning to understand what those afflictions are. And the loving compassion is trying to release that from myself and getting rid of that anger. And you talked about someone coming in and that thought to emotion basis, is that's more like changing our perception on the whole ordeal. Is that basically what we're trying to do, is see that in a different light through going through all of that?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, that's because right now we have so many habitual reactions to things that stimulate our reactions, you know, thoughts, feelings, emotions, stories that we tell ourselves. And that these reactions are very immediate. Like I say, it's like 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. And so this is why shamatha is important, because it slows that process down. And then practicing compassion meditation allows us to key into a different feeling when we recognize that negative mental affliction arising in us. For example, one of my friends said, I feel it's bad to be mad. You know, he really gets mad at himself when he becomes angry. But if he could just perceive it a little bit differently and see himself as reacting out of habit, then he can have, and he can actually hopefully see that there is goodness in him underneath that, and that it never has gone anywhere. It has always been there and will never go away. That is, to me, one of the greatest gifts that people can realize from the practice of meditation, is to be loving and kind and compassionate toward themselves and just say, yep, there I go again. And then, but you know, I'm just going to keep getting up and walking. You know, I'm going to fall down, but I'm going to get up and walk. I'm just going to keep getting up. And I think that compassion for oneself and that knowledge of what our mental afflictions are helps us with other people. Because once we see that we're like the little hamsters running in the wheel of our habits, we can see they're doing it too. Now, we may still, I mean, this doesn't mean we're going to say that people who do bad things shouldn't go to jail and that kind of stuff. You know, we're not going to go there. But But the fact of the matter is, you can put people in jail or put them in some type of correction, but at the same time care for them as human beings. So this is the conundrum of being human, in that we feel things so deeply and we can be overwhelmed by our feelings. We feel things so deeply that we think that we have to like respond and react, when we could actually just be with those things. You know, we don't have to jump. We can actually just be with those things and see what's going on and begin to see the nuances of things. Human beings, I like to say, we like extremes because at least we know where we are. You know, the blind expression of an emotion, or, you know, the sort of wrong-headed, directionless expression of emotion, as opposed to the wrong-headed suppression of an emotion. We can go to the extremes. It's middle that we have trouble with. And that's why it's so cool that the Buddha just came right out and called what he was doing the middle path. He's just saying, look, people, I know this is hard for you. We're doing middle, and you got to stick with me because it's, middle is not easy. But there you go. And here we are. We're all here trying to do middle. So I like it. I really appreciate these questions that people are asking today. Well, because of time, we'll have to stop here. But and I want to apologize for imperfections in the presentation. I've sort of threw myself off a bit. But I do want to thank all of you for bringing your open-mindedness to the messy portions of my presentation, and encourage you to look at some of the pictures online. And I'll put them, I'll try and post them on Facebook too, so that you can get a sense of some of those illustrations. So we'll close here for today and do our dedication of merit. This is a very Buddhist thing to do. At the end of any program, we like to dedicate our merit. Oh, before we leave this, I did promise. I promised Lama Tom that I would put in a little advertisement for his program. That's happening with Sue Erlewine, who is here, and Dr. Jenkins, who is also here. So they're going to be working together on the program that's titled "The Ageless Dharma and the Aging Practitioner." even if you're in your 30s, you might be able to attend this because you're just beginning to say, "I feel old." And this might help you to understand your parents and grandparents a little bit better, but what they're going through. So anyway, that's next Saturday from, I believe it's 10 to 1. It's either 10 to 1 or 10 to 12, but it's one of those. And 9:30. Is it 9:30? Okay, yeah, okay. My bad, you got to look it up. Next Saturday, we're here. We'll be here doing that. So thank you. Well, let's gather together all the goodness that we accomplished talking about virtue today and make that dedication to all sentient beings. We'll recite the verses in English first and then recite them in Tibetan. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. And now I'll recite this in Tibetan, and you can join in if you like, and dedicate the merit. Oso nam dihi tam che se pa ni
Tobne ne petra nam pam jene ke ga na chi pa la tru pa hi si be so le tro war tro war shor Jam pa pa ho ji tar ken pa tang kun tu sam po te yan te shin te de da kun ki che su ta lo ching Ge wa di ta tam che rap tu mo.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for coming, and we'll see you next time. And thank you to the sound department.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.